About a year and a half ago, that I went to B.B. King's to see a band called Blue by Nature. And I saw a lady perform that completely blew me away. And I think I wrote a little piece about it in a magazine, and I think I referred to her as singing from the bottom of her feet.
I don't remember.
And I have the great pleasure and privilege of having Miss Karen Lawrence here today. An amazing lady.
Okay, you can get up off your knees now.
Thank you very much. An amazing lady and a truly wonderful human being. And by the way, this is the Blue Power Hour, and I'm John R. And sitting directly across from me is Miss Karen Lawrence. Hi, Karen. How you doing?
Hi, good. After that introduction.
Have mercy.
Yeah,
So we've been sitting here now for several hours and having a wonderful time. And hopefully we're going to be able to get the pictures up, some of the video up. For you to be able to see.
Oh, yeah.
And we've been selecting music and talking about music. And so I'm going to start by asking you some questions, some rather silly ones, actually. Like, where were you born? Where are you from?
Uh-huh. I'm familiar with those questions. Are you asking me now?
I'm asking you
now. This is actually the actual question.
This is it.
I was born in Long Beach, California, but I was raised in... The year after that, we lived in Fullerton, California, which is in Orange County, very near Disneyland. Very near Disneyland. And everybody, in fact, in my neighborhood tries to work at Disneyland. I never got the gig, but I guess I wasn't Disney fair, but, you know, I did try out for the parades.
You must have gone to Disneyland several times.
So. Yeah, in fact, when I was in high school, they still had that A through E ticket system, and
The E ticket ride.
Oh yeah, but the E ticket was before you bought the tickets. In high school, we used to pay $2.50 for admission, and go in and see. I've seen Buddy Rich several times. I've seen Count Basie. I saw Duke Ellington, and there were some Doc Severinsen's band played there. Dizzy Gillespie. I saw him at Tomorrowland State for $2.50. And there was a great band, Teddy Buckner, I think it was, who played on the stage right near the Haunted House. And there was like a Dixieland trio. They were incredible. And we were all into jazz and blues and jazz bands. And, you know, you couldn't get that. I mean, you don't get that now.
No.
I mean, I've seen Buddy Rich do his solo right there next to him on the top of the hi-hat stem, whatever that thing is, you know. That's great.
Buddy Rich, incredible player.
Oh, my God, yeah. Always a good band.
I have this list of music in front of me, and it reads like a who's who. And it spans the world, and it spans the...
The ages?
The musical persuasion.
Okay, and, what's that?
But there was a piece of music here, I'm going to find it here, that we will play. And we're going to, since you picked so much music, we're going to touch on pieces that influenced you. But
I want to tell them how much stuff I really brought, right? I probably had to wheel that thing in.
Well, she drove up, and she came in with a cooler full of albums.
This one of those
CDs.
Rubbermaid things, you know. Well, I didn't have anything else to put her in.
Well, I thought she's bringing beer.
That's not a bad idea. On a day like today
in the valley, it wouldn't be a bad way. But we were talking about your influences and how you first started. You've been performing for a long time.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, since I was a little kid.
Yeah.
I think, in fact, any opportunity, especially as a... let me back up. When you asked me to prepare some stuff that might have inspired me to be a singer and, you know, got me going, and it was as I kept having to go back, you know, way back, because I always wanted to be. I never really thought about it. I never really said, okay, today I'm going to be a singer and go forward, you know, pursue that. I always really was, and I'd do right down to when anybody would be over at the house, I'd be in the middle of the living room doing a show or talking and trying to be charming, you know, and clever. And we used to do shows in the neighborhood, like our gang. I tell you, if I could have been Darla, you know, or actually maybe Spanky, but it didn't matter. We used to do stuff like that. My sister and I, my sister was more dance-oriented, but we'd both sing together and put on little shows in the neighborhood with curtains and seats and admission tickets. And, I mean, as much as we could do, we did. And my mom sang and my dad sang, not professionally, semi-professionally. And so it was just always a part of things, you know. As soon as I could be the soloist in grade school, as soon as I could be a soloist, I was, you know.
Well, you were on record the first time when you were, what, 12 years old?
Yeah, the choir made a record, right. Yeah. And
what,
I did that.
What choir was it?
It was the Wilshire Junior High Choir, directed by, even outside of my mom and my family, my choir teacher, Catherine Thorson, really pulled me out of the group and started teaching me things and, you know, made me the soloist and made me stand up and sing parts alone and, you know, really just brought me out. And that song, or the Whenever You're Gonna Play It, was one that Mahalia Jackson also did. But I had never heard her version, and I wish I had, because I didn't really know what to do with it. And with my little falsetto kind of voice at the time, which was a choir voice, you know, I sang other styles, but a lot of folk. I did a lot of folk back then. My girlfriend and I had a little duo, and we did folk songs like All My Trials and Peter, Paul, and Mary. And
you play?
Yeah.
Play?
Yeah, in fact, my girlfriend, the reason I played, I was doing a ventriloquist thing. I told you that. I did a ventriloquist thing just out of the blue. I saw it at a toy store. I got it for Christmas within about a month. And in another month, a contest was going on for a television show, a talent contest. And I actually auditioned for it and got on the show. It was Channel 13. It's called Fun for All. And I did that for about a year. And then my girlfriend got a guitar for Christmas. She didn't even tell me she was going to get a guitar. And then she got a guitar and started taking lessons. And I got one to copy her. And we both started learning together, you know, Red River Valley or whatever, down in the valley. And as soon as I could play or pluck, I'm not kidding, four strings. I was playing four strings. I wasn't even playing the fifth and sixth string on the guitar, the two bottom strings. As soon as I could do that, I incorporated it into my act.
Into your act.
Oh, so pathetic. I would play Streets of Laredo. And then Streets of Laredo and Stu Ball Was a Racehorse.
Oh, yeah.
Picking, finger picking. And anyway, so I started out doing that, and just I finally learned to play the other two strings.
Excellent. Excellent. Well, so you made your first record at 12. And by the way, you also mentioned that you were a ventriloquist.
Yeah. Yeah.
Do you still do that?
I did do it as late as 1989 when I was in that Russian band. They found out that I did that, you know, I was goofing off, and I guess I was bragging. I quit doing it when I was about 12, 13, junior high. It was kind of embarrassing as a, you know, going through puberty and trying to be cool. It seemed really corny to me.
Did you have a puppet?
Oh, yeah, his name was Miguel.
Miguel?
Yeah, he was named the Spanish version of my boyfriend's name at the time, Michael.
Right.
I was 9 when I started that. God, 9 years old. And without even a thought that I might not be good, you know, it never occurred to me. You know, I just did it, and people had to watch. And actually, I was good. I was really good, but I couldn't write. I still can't write. I can't write comedy. If it's spontaneous, you know, a lot of people will say, hey, you can do comedy. I have no desire to write that. That's a very hard thing to do. You know, that's a lot of work. Oh, you know.
That's an art.
It is.
It really
it's a lifetime work. But I could never write, and I'd get these acts, A-C-T-S, from old sketches, you know. And, Winchell Mahoney was happening then.
Oh, yeah.
Remember that?
Yeah.
Winchell Mahoney. So this is
all
what made. That's right. And so I wanted to do it because of that, you know. So anyway, in the Russian band in about 1989, they found out I did it, and so I got a brand new one, custom made by one of the only men in the country who does it, and I wish I could remember his name, Rene. He does Disney stuff and everything, and He made me a new puppet, and I never called him a puppet. Oh my, I didn't have a word for it. I couldn't. It was like a human. Oh, I also got freaked out like the Twilight Zone.
Oh yes,
series. I did that.
It went through my mind.
It did. It did. It did happen because it was an alter ego, and I couldn't put it down, and I couldn't make any of those wisecracks without him, and it just. I freaked myself out. I mean, I purposely tried to look at it cross-eyed and as he sat in the closet and purposely freaked myself out so that I would be dramatic and all that. But I did pull it out during the Russian gig, and I dressed him up like a Cossack, a gypsy, and we did a show at the beginning of this international music program that would go on, and it was a gypsy show. I just saw it the other day, too, showing a friend. Talk about embarrassing. I'm dressed like a gypsy. Speaking in 1989, I mean, this is recently. I wasn't a kid. I don't have an excuse. I was getting paid for this, dressed like a gypsy, with this little gypsy next to me, and I made his outfit and everything. It's very cute. And we did a gypsy show, and he was Kolya, which is Michael in Russian. And I spoke a Russian accent, and I kept my voice very low, so that when he would speak, his voice was like this. And it was just pathetic. And trying to do comedy cross culture lines is, you know, they don't really understand if I said, oh, and the best thing he could do was buy me a hot dog. You know, if that was a funny punchline, to an American, a Russian person doesn't get it.
Yeah.
It ain't, what? A hot dog is wonderful. I don't know. Not the same.
I didn't realize until today that you had made so many records. You know, it's always fascinating to me that I think I know somebody, you know, at least a little bit, and then I realize I really don't know them at all.
No,
and,
I like that.
Yeah, it's all. I like to learn something new every day, and boy, today I learned a lot.
Oh, cool.
But I mean, you made
a lot of useless information, but nevertheless,
you've made. Yeah, no. Well, you never can tell when it'll be useful. But
true.
You made how many LPs have you made? How many records have you made?
Seven, eight now.
Yeah.
1975 was the first one. That band was the L.A. Jets. I did not have anything to do with naming it. They were all into sports. I mean, all I could think of was stuff like Red Wing. You know, I wanted something interesting like that, and then they named a tennis shoe that or whatever. That band made two albums. The second one was not released. The second one had Prisoner on it, which was the one that Barbara Streisand sang in the movie Eyes of Laura Mars. I stuffed that in there.
Yeah.
I did two albums on A&M with the band 1994. I did not have anything to do with that name either. It was pretty interesting, though, that name. Instead of 1984, our producer named it, well, it's 10 years from now.
You were advanced.
Yeah, he wanted to advance us even further. Now it's history. You know what I'm saying?
Yeah.
History.
Yeah.
We all got together, though. Several of us called each other in 1994 before the new year ended. Anyway, two albums on A&M, and then one that Fred Hostetler, who is in the band with me now, he and I did one on RCA in 1980. And then Fred and I did one on a small English label, 86, I think. And then I guess this one, these last two with this band. So what does that equal? I don't know. Two, four.
I wasn't counting. I'm bad at math anyway.
Someone might call in and let us know how many was that.
Absolutely. But you've been doing it a long time, mm-hmm. and you mentioned that your mom and your dad were also performers.
Mm-hmm.
Whenever so they come. It comes basically naturally.
Yeah, I say I just popped out this way. It's really true.
Well, I tell you.
I could dance at three.
They supported you, though, right?
Yeah. Oh, but my parents drove me to the first band gig I ever had. I came home. I'd been in a music store. My girlfriend that I sang with was writing down the lyrics to a song, and I wish I could remember which song it was. It was either Mr. Tambourine Man or Green Tambourine. You remember that?
Yeah.
Listen while I play. My green tambourine. Yeah. I think it was that song. I'm not sure. But she was, I was singing it, and she was writing them down because we didn't want to buy the sheet music. Which, of course, nowadays I would do, knowing that you must support these things. But anyway, and a guy said, you want to be in our band? And I thought, well, sure, what an idea. You know, I never thought about it. And that night they had rehearsal, and my parents drove me.
Excellent.
Yeah. They loved it. I mean, my mom used to book me in all these little weird shows I used to do and stuff. She's not an aggressive stage mother like that, but they totally loved everything like this. Yeah, they loved it.
That's great, because when I told my parents I wanted to be a musician, my stepfather says, well, you're going to be a bum. You're going to be getting cigarette butts.
God, what was he, clairvoyant? I mean, was he psychic or what? Cool.
Yeah, absolutely.
Wish he was around. We could talk to him now.
Yeah, well, yeah, I wish he was around now. I made his life miserable.
Oh, well.
But it was amazing because he thought I was going to be a bum, and yet he owned the night. He was in the nightclub business.
Really?
Yeah, and so when I finally had success with what I was doing, he wanted me to come and play.
Oh, cool. What a triumph.
Yeah, but it was hard to hear over the breaking glasses and the pinball machines.
And forks on the plate.
Forks on the plate. Ice in the glasses. But you're on the road an awful lot.
Yeah, we play all the time now.
Yeah.
Yeah. We don't go out that much. I'm not... In the old days, I was on the road. I had nothing. I had no apartment. I had no furniture. You know, everything I had was in a suitcase or a three or four. And I just can't get into that now. You know, that was like completely roaming, gypsy-like, you know, 20 years old. It didn't matter. But now I got a house, I mean, and I got two dogs, and I got my little schedule. You know, it's not really very much of a schedule, but
you have responsibilities now.
Well, it's not even responsibilities, it's just I got a pattern I like. I like to work out, I like to do what I want to do. I mean, you know, I really never had kids, so I could do that. And I, when we go on the road, I have to like be on good behavior. In the old days, I didn't do that. I would go out and party all night long and have no voice and eventually lose it several times. But now I'm on good behavior. I can't go out after the gigs, and I don't talk in the morning, and I don't talk in the truck, and I don't talk long on the phone, and, you know, everybody else can goof off but me.
Well, I was thinking, I remember the first time I saw you, and I thought to myself, how does this girl do this every night?
Yeah.
Because, I mean, you sing flat out.
Yeah.
You don't hold anything back.
Yeah, it's a lot of singing.
Yeah,
you know. Even, it's only been this good, honestly, since I went to this coach. Florence Riggs, if you want to know, Seth Riggs' wife. And I did go to her. I'd gone to a couple, but it didn't quite sink in. And I worked on what they had taught me for years. But I guess going to a female and being a female, I could relate immediately to where she was trying to put me, you know, and what she was saying. And it absolutely changed everything. That, going to Florence Riggs, singing in a gospel church, and singing in the Russian band, totally changed everything for me.
What gospel church?
Oh, the big one. I sang at the First African Methodist Episcopalian Church in Los Angeles, FAME. It was a great experience. I only got to do it for 6 months because then our band started playing on the weekends and the rehearsal is on Friday nights in the youth choir. And it was a great experience. I mean, I take so much, like arrangements, what they do with arrangements. I mean, they milk it. You know, and milk the ending of that song and milk that chord and with no reservations. Like, oh, that's just too much. Oh, it's too corny. No, it's great. It's just tension and opening up like that. You know, you kind of open up and just let it come into you. Let whatever, the force, whatever, comes into you and so you can get it out. If you're lucky, that doesn't always happen, but... you come close, you know.
Yeah, when I was in Atlanta and I was playing in various bands, we would play Saturday night, of course, get off at 1:45, bar time. And then we'd go to Johnny Reb's and have breakfast and hang out and drink coffee till about 4:30 in the morning. Then we'd pack, you know, had all our stuff packed up. Then we'd go across the railroad tracks to the Wheat Street Baptist Church.
Ooh.
And we would set up on the stage, and normally there would be there'd be one or two drummers, a bass player, a piano player, a B3 player,
sax, trumpet.
Horns, a whole horn section. Yeah. And we would do the first service, which was at 6:30 in the morning.
Oh, my God.
And then we'd go home and go to bed. But, I mean, just the singing. And that church held 1,000 people.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. That's,
you know,
cool.
What I mean?
And, you had the experience.
And I never realized, I am Episcopalian, but mm-hmm. talk about straight-laced. Where I came from, I mean, it was very...
Oh, me too. They didn't sing in my church.
And nobody clapped.
Oh, yeah. Oh, hand praise.
That's
clapping.
Heaven forbid.
Oh, noise. Yeah. Noise. Yeah. Please, give me some noise.
No,
you know,
feedback.
People responding. Oh.
There was no feedback.
There was nothing in church when I went. I mean, people passed out out of just sheer boredom.
I went to sleep.
I mean, it's most interesting thing to me was my patent leather shoes.
Oh, absolutely.
Oh, this was nothing like it.
Passing notes.
Yeah. You know, I always thought that they should take kids on field trips to other churches of different denominations. You know, everybody should see what goes on, and in a healthy way, you know, in every kind of church. I mean, I wish I had known. I had no idea.
Now, the first song that we put on the list here.
What was it?
It Takes a Lot to Laugh, Takes a Train to Cry. The L.A. Jets, you mentioned them, right?
Yeah.
Bob Dylan was a writer. That
mm-hmm.
song, right?
And we did it in a Bob Dylan studio, too.
Right.
Up in Sausalito, with a Bob Dylan engineer or producer. Bob Johnson was the producer of that record. And, oh, man, they had me do that thing 1,000 times. They're all in behind the control room drinking beer and having a great time. Baby, that was great. Can you do one more time? It's like, are you paying me to be the entertainment tonight? They used to do that all the time to me. The way I go off on the ending, you know.
It all added up, though, didn't it?
Yeah, I like that. Off of that album... That's one that I like. And, in fact, we may do that song sometime.
Yeah.
It won't sound anything like that.
No.
But that was 1975.
And then the next song is The Persuasions. Buffalo Soldier.
That's a great album and a great band.
Yeah. Because I grew up in the South.
And, oh, did you?
Yeah, you know. I remember,
where?
Georgia.
Georgia.
An island off the coast of Savannah. And I remember
seriously?
Buying, please, 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 James Brown.
I brought that album.
You're kidding.
I brought that, and that is the one I was going to play for you.
See? Isn't that amazing?
Please.
That's right.
Please. I wrote a song like that. What is it? I did. I haven't done it yet. I wrote a song like that.
Oh,